Welcome to Not Terrible.
I'm Jess Hooker.
And I'm Mary Graham. This is episode 36 of the Not Terrible podcast. On today's episode, we're discussing addiction and romantic relationships, how it affects us emotionally, physically, and socially. Not Terrible, a field guide for the hopeless optimist.
I grew up surrounded by addiction. Not necessarily always in my own household, but family, friends, people. It was so acceptable in our family circle that I didn't really notice it. And then someone told me in therapy as an adult that we recreate the relationships of our childhood in our adult life so that we can have a better ending. I wish I would have known that. Like when I turned 18, I wish somebody would have stamped that on my arm so that I was aware of what I was doing and who I was meeting and which relationships I was trying to recreate so that I could have a happy ending instead of the ongoing turmoil. I don't think that there's ever an ending when you grow up with addiction in your family. But I think that you hope for a better outcome, maybe not an ending.
Yeah, I learned that too. Obviously, we have the same counselor of learning that the traumas that we've experienced or the ways that we have been hurt as children, our brain wanting to heal that wound will search out similar situations later on in life with the hopes of it ending differently to heal ourselves. But what happens the majority of the time is we just get into the same cycle that the people that hurt us are in, and we join that like generational cycle of whatever it is that has hurt us
because it's comfortable and we know how to deal with that dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Or we, at least we think we do.
We know how to live within it. Yeah.
Survive it. Yeah, we knew how to survive it. Not that you can do that well, but it was comfortable and it's how we grew up. And so when those characteristics and those events started to surface before I was aware that it was addiction, I just thought, oh, okay, I know how to deal with this. I know how to deal with secrecy and just all the things that come with addiction. I know how to deal with someone withdrawing from my life, from someone not wanting to be around me.
Manipulating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know how to deal with not feeling worth in a relationship. Oh, I know how to do all this. Mm-hmm. I'm good at this. Oh, I've been doing this my whole life.
So for me, I didn't really grow up around addiction. It wasn't very present in my life, but thinking about that wound from a wound from childhood is I grew up with a very influential relationship that had two wounded people trying to fix or not fix each other in a way that didn't end well. And one person saw the other person as wounded and wanted to save them. And the other person was adamant that he or she was fine.
Yeah.
So there was just like this continual cycle of I can fix you. Well, nothing's wrong with me. I can fix you. And just like wounded bird and victim cycle. So And I know this only through a lot of work, then flashing forward to me being in my early 20s and meeting someone who was very broken and not seeing that brokenness as a sign of warning, but as a way to jump back in that cycle of trying to fix someone that needed a lot of work, unaware of what I was doing. I did that when I met Chris Graham, and then only, you know, come to find out later, a lot of the brokenness centered around addictions that were family generational addictions. No one had spoken up and they had hid them for a long time, and they were doing a lot of damage in lots of ways. So I married into a family of addiction.
I think that it's not uncommon for people in relationship, but I'm going to go ahead and take a leap and say women in relationship look at a man and they'll say, "Oh, I can, you're not all right. Your hygiene could use some help. You leave clothes all over the floor. You don't remember to pay your bills. Like, these are things I can work with. This is just messy enough that I'm going to feel like I accomplished something in making you the perfect man, the perfect mate." But usually those are like little tiny precursors of something much, much bigger under the surface, whether it's addiction or childhood trauma, which usually those two things go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
We've always made that joke that women want to save men, but that's another generational.
And I struggle with that because the idea, if something in my brain says I can save someone else, I am also unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Because a healthy person understands boundaries and would not think I could fix you.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of explains Chris and I's dating life and when we first started being in relationship, is that I was unaware of my unhealth. He was hiding all of his unhealth. And so neither one of us was healthy enough to see maybe some warning signs. And if we could teach our daughters the thought that we can save someone or fix someone, it is not our job. And it's also, if we look in the mirror when we're thinking that, it might be some things that we need to work through.
Mm-hmm. I know that mine is some pretty intense codependence that I grew up with. I grew up with that codependence is healthy, that it's safe, that it's almost martyr-like. Like, oh, look, you know, you're gonna make everybody's problems your own, and you're gonna save people, and so it was a good thing. I didn't have that verbiage for a long time, the codependence part. But that was how I was recreating my relationships, was going, oh, I'm codependent, and my worth lies in this person, my ability to help this person.
Like that savior complex.
Oh,
kind of.
Oh yeah, yeah, big time. And the women in my family love that shit. Love it, love it, love it. Wear mm-hmm. it like a badge of honor.
Mm-hmm.
And the majority of the time it backfires and it ends in sadness and divorce
and
broken hearts.
Yeah,
exactly. So it never works out, but you always think you're going to be the one that fixes it. You're the one that's going to do it differently this time.
Without ever thinking, maybe I need to fix myself first.
No, I'm good.
Right.
I'm good. I'm saving people. I am. Look at all of the beautiful things that I am bringing to other people's lives just by being here and telling them how they're wrong and how we're going to fix it.
Cool.
See, doesn't that sound like a good idea? Doesn't that sound like a lot of fun?
Yeah, that sounds fun. Yeah. Come on, guys. But it actually, like you said, it backfires. So we end up with all these new hurts and new wounds and new struggles, and long term, you realize you're setting your own kids up to do this again, and that's where it becomes personal and like kind of lights my fire, is that the things that I struggle with or the things that I have done that I know I should do better in, my kids are learning patterns from me, and that's what makes me change, because I don't want them to live like I am living.
And it's, to be a little more transparent than I had anticipated, I also have an addictive personality and I struggle with addiction too. So this isn't just my partner being addicted. It is also me. And I'm sure that he has a side of the story to tell also. I struggle with alcohol abuse. Still struggle regularly, daily. Mary and I have talked about it. I don't really have a name for it. It's hard to say that you're an alcoholic. But it's a gray area alcoholism. It consists of binge drinking and things. And Mary and I have planned on doing an episode about it next season. So we'll touch on that more. So I'm not just speaking as the partner of an addict, but I'm speaking as an addict in a relationship also. I don't have the foresight to say this is what we did or this is what worked or this is how we got through this because we're still in the thick of it. It's still messy and it's still ugly and there's more good days than there are bad finally. And so I feel like we're on the other side of it a little bit. It's hard to say that out loud because I've thought this before and man, was I wrong. Because Mary, you know all too well that when you think you're over the hard part, it gets harder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's important to know that one of the struggles, one of the hardest things for me being in a relationship with someone that has addictive tendencies is there is no end. And I'm not saying that because he's using now, but once you say out loud or you admit that you're addicted to something, you will for the rest of your life be an addict of whatever your drug of choice or thing of choice is. You just get to say recovering in front of it if you're not actively participating in it. So addiction is a hard life. It's a really hard life to live. And I think when I actively try to break the cycle that we're in for my daughters, it's because I don't want them to have this hard life that we have now.
Mary, you told me about a book called Adult Children of Alcoholics.
Mm-hmm.
And I read it thinking this doesn't apply to me, but maybe it does. I don't know. I need to read more about it. It's a lot deeper than people think. There's a lot of different scenarios of alcohol within your family dynamic and how it affects that dynamic and the roles that are played in your family.
Mm-hmm.
So I highly recommend that if there was someone drinking in your house growing up, get this book and read it, and it will make a lot of things make sense. There is also, I didn't anticipate this, but there is a scenario where a parent starts drinking and stops drinking within your childhood, and that made me think of my kids. And I read it and how much it applies to my children already. And now my kids have to identify. And maybe someday read this book. And man, I did not want to be the person that gives them that book. Because I'm the person that caused that pain.
So when I tell my story of living with and being married to an addict and an alcoholic, there are some things, obviously I've shared a lot of parts of our story on this podcast, in my writing, on social media, but I normally do it from my point of view, because Chris's story is not my story, and so talking about that book, Adult Children of Alcoholics, which we'll link to in the show notes. If you did grow up in a household with an alcoholic, you need to read that book. Like, that's not us suggesting that. That's us demanding it.
Yeah.
And there are, so my husband is one of three kids, and growing up in a house with an alcoholic doesn't mean you all look the same. There are different roles. There are different titles for what it does to you, because we all have different personalities and we all react to wounds and trauma differently, and age and birth order and a million other things kind of come into that.
Yeah.
For my husband, he is the lost child, the one that as long as he was quiet, nobody hurt him or paid attention to him. But that also means as an adult, he doesn't know how to engage in relationship in a healthy way, because he, as long as he was quiet, he didn't cause anyone any problems or didn't get the attention or the wrath of his father. So now in our house, we are struggling with making Chris engage in our lives.
Yeah.
Because it's always been safer for him to not. And so while I love, like, and this is a silly example, but I love that my husband loves to read, but he also disconnects from our family when he reads. And before it was, he'd watch TV all the time. So there are just ways that you can, still as an adult, live in the pain of those childhood patterns that you picked up. Him engaging now is hard because he doesn't know what a healthy conversation, or like, he doesn't know how to do it well, and he's working on it. Like, he spends a lot of time in counseling doing that and talking about it and then trying out new things. But it makes me sad for him and for my girls, though. Like, one, he knew as a child that nobody engaged him, which makes me sad for his childhood. And then it makes me sad for my girls, that they're not getting the best parts of their dad because someone shut them down a long time ago.
My situation was the opposite, in that I looked for things to make life easier for my parents, being the oldest of four. And I think that Chris and I share some of these qualities. We cared for and looked after our siblings. I knew that I was being helpful, and I assumed that the only way I would be able to receive love was if I made myself helpful. What can I do for you? How can I serve you? How can I make your life easier so that I know that you love me?
So that you need me and you won't leave
me. Leave me. Yeah, exactly. So carrying that into an adult relationship, into a romantic relationship, on the surface, that looks like, wow, you are a very
attentive,
dutiful, attentive mm-hmm. wife. And wow, this is amazing. I mean, it's an easy sell as a woman mm-hmm. to come from an addictive family. But the thing is that the only people that are picking up what you're selling are people as dysfunctional as you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then all of that dysfunction comes to the surface, and some of it comes sooner and some of it comes later.
I like the trickle out effect. Like that's how we've lived. It's just slowly over time.
Yeah.
Shocking. So that you just don't collapse all at once. Like you just get little bits.
Yeah.
And that's said with sarcasm, you know, like the.
Yeah.
All the shit doesn't explode at one time. It leaks out in little cracks over a couple years.
Ours started 5 years ago, with the realization that, my partner had addictive tendencies, had some issues, and we've talked about this before, the dry drunk term, and it applies to all addictions, I think, now that I know what it is. So a dry drunk is someone who stops drinking but doesn't do any more healing or coping or working through the mess that they made while they were drunk.
Or the wounds and the hurts that they had that drove them to drink to begin with. They don't address them. They just stop addressing them with alcohol.
Right.
So they're still angry and broken and depressed
and
victimhood.
And in withdrawal.
Yes. Yeah. So they're just adding.
Yeah.
Adding. Yeah.
Yeah. So my partner stopped, and that's all that happened. It was never discussed again. It was never talked about again. And I thought that was a good thing. Until I realized that I hadn't dealt with how I had been affected, and so I started drinking to deal with that. And then for us, it all blew up in about, like, within 2 years. It was a terrible 2 years. Well, it's working towards being a terrible 3 years. I don't know. Like I said, I hope we're on the other side of it, but it's not over. And I can honestly say it's been the worst 2 years of my life. And I can also attribute the fact that I have drank more than I've ever drank in my life in the last 2 years. That's not just about him and his issues. And I wasn't just drinking. Like, you can't say no one makes another person drink. No one makes another person drug. No one makes another person view pornography. No one, that it just isn't. Like, I can't blame him. I was dealing with things from my childhood. I was dealing with the alcoholism and the drug use I saw growing up. And it was just triggered at that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I know that emotionally you feel inadequate. I did anyway, being in a relationship with someone that struggled with pornography addiction, that I'm not pretty enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not, apparently I'm terrible in bed. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of thoughts that actually have zero to do with the actual illness that they're dealing with. I felt like a very, very small person. I felt like I had let this man shape me into this woman who just thought that she was worthless, that had no value, and that's what made me so angry. My codependency in this relationship had shaped me into just this sad shell of a person.
And unfortunately, I know enough about addiction now to know that that's a really common thing. Like, no matter the addiction, the people that love that addict, they get the worst of it. I mean, obviously, an addict is in a lot of pain, and they're not going to tell you about it, and they probably don't have the words to, but, like, the bystanders get all the hits.
Mm-hmm. And I had convinced myself that I was deserving of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had this coming, you know. You also learn something in therapy that if it's not you, it would have been somebody else. It's not, you can't take these things personally. You can't take the actions of an addict personally, because if he wouldn't have married you, he would have married somebody else and the exact same thing would have happened.
Mm-hmm. And that's hard, because then you don't feel as special and shiny.
Right. No, then, he was comfortable with me, right? Yeah. Like, this is why this happened. Right. He needed me to work through this.
Mm-hmm.
This is why it came out now, because he wouldn't have been this comfortable around another woman. No, I'm special. This
yes.
is, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Not true.
Somewhere in the back of my head. So, and this is, again, long before any romantic relationship, I was always given the impression, either intentional or not intentional, that I was a little too much, a little too hard to handle, a little too loud, a little too opinionated, a little too smart, a little too quick to say things. So then here comes this addiction in Chris's life, and addiction lies to the addict, but it also lies to everybody else too. And an addict, their first love is that drug or that computer or that drink. And they will do anything to preserve that relationship. That's their number one relationship. So manipulating, playing on your weaknesses, playing on your hurts is like par for the course for addiction. So when all of Chris's drinking kind of came to light and he was having conversations with people other than me, he was quick to tell people how hard it was to be married to me and how demanding I was and how exhausting it was to be married to me. And while those things are sort of true, just in general, I would agree with those to an extent. Those are not excuses or valid reasons to be an alcoholic, because that makes you a victim, mm-hmm. as opposed to somebody who would make any healthy choices for someone who sounds horrible to be married to.
Right. And that's such a socially acceptable thing for a man to do.
To complain about his wife.
And to drink about it.
And to drink about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's one.
That's a tired, tired storyline. Well, like,
as tired as women saying, my kids are making me crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm going to drink a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we live in a world that has glorified that relationship of a bad day or a hard week or a tough day at work, and then we get to reward ourselves with alcohol, or we get to justify drinking too much or smoking pot or whatever we like to do because we deserve it. And nobody starts out to be an addict. Like, nobody takes their first drink and hopes one day that they're drinking hand sanitizer at the bathroom of a doctor's office, but for some of us, that's where it goes. And yeah, and the hard part is how do you know you're going to go off the rails when you drink? And I think for my kids, no more secrets about a family that struggles with addiction. No more secrets with not speaking out loud what things can do to your body or your mind or how you might have addictive tendencies. And we need to talk about that from a really young age. We'll talk about it in the appropriate language right now, but as you get older and you become more independent and you're going around alcohol and you're not around your parents and when you're with your friends and peer pressure and what the movies make you think looks cool, like we're going to have some really hard conversations and some really honest conversations about what you might not be able to do.
The way that I felt manipulated was that, I guess a nice way to put it was that I'm a pretty humble person. And the best thing I can say about myself is that I'm not ugly. And I think that my partner played into the fact that I didn't think that I was that pretty or that I was that thin or that I was attractive. It just worked out that it was like, wow, I really, really, you know, he's way over my head. I'm really lucky. I'm so lucky. I'm so fortunate that he chose me. And so I'm going to keep my head down and my mouth shut. And I manipulated him because he is a really good secret keeper. And I knew no matter how drunk I was or how loud I was or how angry I was or how physical I was, he wouldn't tell anyone. I feel like talking about the physical effects of addiction is really easy when someone is addicted to pornography. There is a website that... it's called Porn Kills Love. And they have a 3-part documentary right now about how pornography affects every part of your life and what happens. I mean, even the science behind how any addiction reroutes your brain and pornography specifically will kill your ability to feel love, to receive love, to understand love, all of it. It goes away. And to physically be rejected. By someone who is addicted. I don't know if there's a worse feeling. To feel that from your partner. The one way you're supposed to. With the one person, the one way that you show love like that, that's supposed to be beautiful and you're supposed to feel so connected and understood
and safe.
And it's all of the opposite. You feel violated. You feel embarrassed. You feel scared. You feel, because why don't I feel this? Why don't I feel this for him? What's wrong with me? Why am I broken? But it's all a part of the projection and the manipulation going on within the relationship to keep his addiction safe. And instead of withdrawing, I kept trying. I kept trying to find that connection, kept wanting it and thinking of other ways you can fulfill it, and let's try something new, or let's do this, or, you know, let's go on a date, or prepare his favorite meal, or, oh my gosh, stop nagging him so much, and maybe that'll help, and, you know, basically be as helpful as possible and as invisible as possible, and maybe he'll love you more.
Welcome back to your childhood home.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to take a break, mostly because we need new Kleenexes, and I don't want any more crusty Kleenexes from Jesse's desk. when we come back, we will talk about where do we go from here. All right, so we're taking a break. I want to talk real quick about the next workshop coming up at the Front Room Studio. On Saturday, March 9th, we are hosting Amy Sloan, and she is a social media influencer who is going to teach us how to use Instagram for our small businesses. So if you own a small business, have a product that you're selling, would like to do more online business through social media, Amy Sloan will be here on the 9th, and she's going to do a 3-hour workshop with us, teaching us how to use social media for our businesses. She's also coming back in April to do that with us. This is a already been high demand workshop. We're selling out fast. So she's going to come and do another repeat in April if you don't get tickets for this one in March.
Yeah. So even if you don't have a business, but you're considering maybe changing your career, going a different direction and starting a business, and online exposure would benefit that, I suggest you sign up for this workshop.
Mm-hmm. And you can get more information on our Facebook page, Front Room Studio New Palestine. You can see details and buy tickets there.
So welcome back. In the first part, we talked about the emotional and physical effects of addiction in a partnership, and I'll just touch really fast on my personal experience with how these things, our addictions, mutually affected our social lives. Somehow I felt like somebody could see what was going on with us, because with addiction, usually with drugs or alcohol, you can. It's visible. You can see that someone is drunk or high or using. And somehow I thought that, like, it was stamped on my forehead or something, like, I'm not good enough for my spouse. No. Or, you know, and so whenever we would be at parties or at, fundraisers and all dressed up and all these things, I would totally overcompensate and want to just be, like, the most attentive, best wife, look how happy we are. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh, just doting over him. And oh, he's the best, and he's so handsome, and he's the best at his job, and he's the best dad. And I mean, just over the top, like probably make you puke. But then it would just be he and I sitting there, and I would say nothing. And somehow I wanted him to know how disgusted I was with him by not talking to him, but I wouldn't dare want anybody else to know what was going on. And then with me, he stopped taking me places. I was embarrassing. I was loud. I was obnoxious. I'm loud and obnoxious without alcohol. but add alcohol, and I'm a little bit more mean and a little bit more adversarial and opinionated and rude and just all the things that, you know, insert booze, and you can be your worst self in an instant. And all the things that I loved doing with him, he stopped taking me to because I was embarrassing, because I was unpredictable, because I was mean. And it broke my heart, but I don't blame him at all.
For our relationship socially, it's just really odd because so much of what Chris did was in secret. And so when things didn't make sense, I always felt like something was wrong with me. But when everything kind of came out, then more people said things like, well, he always used to I always felt like he stood really close to me, or sometimes he smelled a little, like sometimes I would smell alcohol, but wouldn't know, like I could convince myself I didn't. Or one time he was acting really weird. So all these things that then in hindsight make me feel embarrassed. But now, no, like choosing to live for Chris, choosing to be sober means that there are some friends that we don't have anymore. Which is odd because he didn't drink in public. Chris and I never drank together. He didn't drink with our friends. He always drank alone. But now I view situations where there is alcohol or drinking differently because it just feels different, knowing that it's such a struggle for my husband. So there are times when our good friends that we are still in relationship with will say, like, hey, there'll be alcohol here, or there won't be alcohol, or they'll give us a heads up, and Chris and I will talk about it ahead of time, like, should we go to this, or is this going to make you feel comfortable or uncomfortable? And for me, I still drink. When I say still drink, like I have a drink maybe, I don't know, once every couple of months. Like, we don't keep alcohol in the house, but I was just never really a big drinker since college. And so we have conversations about what's appropriate for me or what's not going to be happening at a party. I know looking back, there are times that he was drunk and acting like a butthole and embarrassing me, and I didn't know why. So as the person that wasn't drinking but was trying to be social with someone that was drunk, I know it hurt you to not be invited, but it's also really embarrassing to be around someone that can't control themselves, you know, like that. And then it made me just feel really bad about myself. I don't know.
It made you look bad. I mean, I just felt like it was, I just flipped it around and thought, if he was behaving this way, I would be embarrassed.
Yeah.
I would be mortified. And another thing was whenever I would just complain, and I would bitch and moan about everybody around me and how much I hated it. And I wanted him to be as miserable as I was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just looking for somebody to sit down there with you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Get down here with me and be as miserable and hurt and scared. Just do all of these things with me. And instead of saying, like, let's heal together,
Right.
I said, let's be miserable together.
Yeah. Like, that's where your brain went, because you're not healthy enough to say anything else. So on the episode that feels kind of really down and messy, I think it's important to point out that any self-awareness that Jess and I have now is not something we just kind of stumbled upon or one day happened. The work that has gone into being aware of our family patterns, being aware of our wounds and how we live out of them, began when we got good counselors, when we got therapy. I often get messages on social media or on my blog asking for how to recover from betrayal or addiction or a horrible relationship or a divorce or just some kind of heartbreak. And obviously, from a Christian point of view, I say Jesus, but then I say Jesus in counseling. Like, we need others to help us get through this. We got into the mess by ourselves. If we could think our way out of it, we would have by now. You need good counseling to be able to start to heal and address and see the things that you're doing in your life that continue to bring you heartache, and start to live differently. And you can't do that on your own. You just can't.
And I know we say often, how do you find a good counselor? Where do you start? I think a good place to start is with your family doctor. They can refer somebody. And if that doesn't work out, start asking the people around you if they have professional help and who they see and who they could recommend.
Yeah. You can call local churches or community centers, and they often give you recommendations also. It doesn't have to be a place you belong to, but a lot of places that are set up for the good of the community will have resources. If you are in a situation where your kids need counseling, a good place to start is the school counselor. It's their job. Like, they're like the social, or they're, a lot of schools have social workers, but the school counselor is equipped to one, help you kind of address some things with your child, maybe if it's interfering with things at school, but then also refer you to other places to get help.
Like Mary always says, we have a lot of information in the show notes, and I think this episode in particular will have a lot. We will link to the websites we discussed. We'll link to the AA website.
The books.
AA also has an awesome app that you can use. There's just so many tools to work through this, whether you are an alcoholic or an addict, or you are in relationship with one. Mm-hmm. This seems weird to say, but...
this is the point, though. We don't want to end with people wanting to poke their eyes out. We have to end... We need to end on a positive note, mm-hmm. to say that we aren't, even though we talk about hard things, we don't immediately turn this recording off and like sob and hold each other.
No.
We
never hold each other. We usually eat something, but this week, my not terrible is that since we were just talking about therapy, I just booked out my therapy for as long as I could in advance, and I'm going to go 7 weeks straight and not miss one session. It's a challenge to myself.
Wow, and you're saying it out loud.
And I'm saying it out loud to more than just myself, so little accountability here.
Were you supposed to be there today?
No, I thought I was a week off. I start next week.
Okay.
Yeah,
I was like, well, here's the thing.
Here's
I think
the thing.
You missed.
You're not going to make it. Yeah. So that's my not terrible, because mm-hmm. I go hit and miss. And this time I was like, no, you really, you got to get in there get both feet wet again and really work through some heavy stuff. And then I get to go on spring break. So that'll be my reward.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's good.
Laying on the beach.
Sunshine, which is even better.
Yes.
My not terrible this week is something you can't actually see, but we're currently recording and I'm holding my dog.
That's true.
And my other dog is at our feet. They're at the office with us today. I have some work going on at my house. Like I've said before, remodeling our kitchen. They're working on the flooring the next couple days. And I just, for the sake of the workers, didn't want to leave my dogs there, especially my new dog. He would just bark, I feel like, for 8 hours. And I couldn't imagine doing that to them. So they came to the office with us, and I'm holding my dog while we record the podcast. Aww. And it's just making me so happy. We'll post a picture on social media when this goes live so everyone can see.
Yeah, for sure.
We got a new little setup, and then my dog's here.
We didn't anticipate having emotional support dogs for this episode, but it has been really helpful. And if you heard some tip-tappy toes throughout the episode, that was Mac and Blue.
Just kind of searching for snacks on the floor as we're recording.
Or eating plants, whichever. All right, we'll see you guys next week.
See ya.
You've been listening to Not Terrible with Jess Hooker and Mary Graham. Connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at Not Terrible Podcast. Visit us at notterriblepodcast.com for show notes and additional content. You can sign up for our newsletter for bonus episodes and podcast extras. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast provider.
When you subscribe, leave us a review. We'd love to share it on the podcast, like this one from Julie at Fairytale Mom, who writes, "Honestly, sharing intimate details about real-life struggles makes Jess and Mary relatable. I love listening, and I think you will too."
Not Terrible Podcast is recorded in conjunction with the Off the Air Podcast. Recorded in the Front Room Studios, this has been a Waco production.